All right. Everybody get your tape recorders ready to go here. We're going. Okay, so we're going to talk about another one of our basic human needs tonight. Can we come together, please? Come together. It's coming around. Sign is coming around. I don't know which way it went, but it's coming around. All right, so we're kind of following along with our basic human needs. And certainly elimination is one maybe we take for granted a little bit sometimes. How important is it to eliminate the waste from our body? We kind of look at this almost as a nuisance, right? Yeah. It gets in our way. You don't want to stop to go to the bathroom. It's kind of like a pain in the butt, literally, right? So, I mean, but we really need to keep in mind that our body has to have a way to get rid of waste products. And if we don't, these poisons build up in our body and can be very detrimental to us. And in fact, over time, can kill us. So one of the things that we have to realize, these basic human needs truly are human needs, correct? We talked about oxygen. We talked about skin integrity. Skin integrity is, even though you think of a pressure ulcer not that big a deal, can kill you. Can immobility kill you?
Yes.
The consequences of immobility, what could kill you? A DVT, it's not going to kill you, but what can a DVT become? Pulmonary embolism. So what's the big push? We need to prevent DVT in the first place. So this is just a little, you know, a review. Like, what are we going to do to prevent DVT? Early ambulation, anticoagulation, exercising those calf muscles. So even though we think immobility isn't necessarily something that is so bad, it can kill you. So what about, let's be comfort. You know, we want to be comfortable, right? How does it feel to be in severe pain? Severe pain can be very debilitating, to the point where it can stress you out to the exhaustion phase, right? And then in exhaustion phase, what happens? You die. So what we're saying here is all these basic needs do,
what's going on?
Oh, but already it's up here? My goodness. So what I'm trying to stress to you guys, when you look at your patients every week in clinical, examine them for all the basic need deficits. Are you doing that?
Yes.
Is it making more sense to you now?
Yes.
And if there's an alteration, someone with a catheter in, that's an alteration in urinary elimination. I'm sure some of you are seeing constipation now, especially with the elderly immobile patient. We're going to talk about constipation tonight. But we need to be dealing with that because the basic need of getting waste products out of our body is very important. And constipation, I mean, you're still making the waste product, but how uncomfortable is it to be constipated? Okay, so definitely something that we want to think about with our patients. So we're going to start off with bladder elimination, urinary elimination. That's where we'll start tonight. Now, I wonder what's going on here. Okay. I did, as you can see, there were a bunch of anatomy and physiology type slides. For the purposes of this lecture, I'm going to cut to the chase here. We don't need them. You can review that stuff. You know I'm not going to ask you anatomy and physiology type questions, but everybody kind of remembers how the urinary system comes together. What are these babies called up here? Of course, like my little thing isn't working anymore, but the kidneys. And the kidneys, I really wish my little thing would work. My laser. Here it goes. What are these things here? It's going in and out. I guess I need new batteries. I guess that's what's going on here. Oh, and it's not going to change. You know what? I think I have to switch batteries real quick. Can you give me a second here? Because I really love my clicker here. Oh, and there is dingers tonight. Clicker questions. If anybody needs a clicker. While I dig for batteries here. Always be prepared as a nurse, right? Have extra batteries.
Can I grab one?
Go ahead, go ahead and grab one. And then we have to hope that that's what the problem was. And that I don't need a new clicker. No, it's not coming on. Thank you. And it would help to put the batteries in the right way. Oh, it's still not working. Oh, there it is. Okay. Yay! Looks like we're back in business. Okay. So then we have two ureters, right?
Yes.
And a bladder and then a urethra. So they're the main organs of the body, which we'll talk about. But the main anatomy of the kidney, I left this one in for a minute, just wanted to kind of show you. The nephron is the functional unit of the kidney. And it kind of looks like a little alveolus, right? It's surrounded by all kinds of little capillaries. And 1 million nephrons in a kidney, and these whole tubules that are absorbing, reabsorbing electrolytes and absorbing water. So this is all a big part of what's working here with the kidney. Now, how urine is formed. This normal glomerular filtration, it's like a filtration system for the body. And there's going to be all this urine, all this fluid that's going to go through the kidney. But you're really only getting a certain amount that actually comes out as urine. So this slide is there. You just have to go a little forward. I just left out a whole bunch of the anatomy and physiology slides. Okay, I just kind of shortened it up a little bit. So what we can look at is a glomerular filtration rate, the amount of blood filtered by the glomerule in any given time. And that gives you a good indication of a patient's kidney or your kidney function. And when you are looking at lab values, not necessarily so much in the nursing home, but when you get to the hospital next semester, something that you can look at on a lab study is something called a GFR or a glomerular filtration rate. Look at that. It will give you a good indication of a patient's renal function. Like I told you, BUN and creatinine do also, but glomerular filtration rate will tell you a lot also. It should be greater than 60. Okay, it should be greater than 60. If it's less than 60, it could indicate the patient has renal insufficiency, okay? And if it's less than 15 or less, it usually means renal failure. The kidneys really aren't functioning. So, and the normal glomerular filtration rate, I have 125, but it's really 60 all the way up to 125 or even higher. If you have a very high glomerular filtration rate, it just means your kidneys are really working well. But you want to have at least 60 milliliters per minute. However, only 1 mL per minute actually becomes urine. The rest is going to be reabsorbed. So there's a lot of reabsorption that occurs in those tubules. And the actual amount of urine that's formed is minute in respect to how much actually goes through those kidneys. Okay? So you guys kind of remember this from anatomy and physiology. There's two different reabsorption and secretion is taking place here. So you can just review those slides. The proximal convoluted tubule, the loop of Henle, remember all that good stuff? Where we're conserving sodium and potassium and chloride and water. The distal convoluted tubule and antidiuretic hormone. I just wanted to mention that for a minute. Now, what does antidiuretic hormone do? Can anybody say in like two words what it does? Okay, conserves water. So when the body needs extra, what would the body need antidiuretic hormone? Any kind of situation where there's a decrease in fluid in the body, like dehydration, right? You really need to conserve water. You don't want to get rid of excess water in the body when the body needs volume to maintain blood pressure and, you know, keep cardiac output up. So the body has a mechanism, instead of, because the kidneys are normally just going to get rid of that excess fluid, get rid of fluid. But in these situations, maybe with antidiuretic hormone going on, you're going to conserve water, your urine output would do what? Drop. It would drop, right? Now, interesting situation though, a lot of times we're going out, we have a little alcohol, right? And alcohol inhibits antidiuretic hormone. So basically what happens when you have a few drinks, you start urinating a lot and you can dehydrate. And that's why you get a hangover. It's inhibiting antidiuretic hormone, the alcohol. So what's happening is you're getting rid of excess water, and you end up, when you're dehydrated, that's one of the signs of dehydration is a headache. So that's why we feel so lousy with a hangover. You're basically dehydrated. Okay, for some of you that didn't know that already. That's why they always tell you when you have a drink, drink a glass of water along with it. Okay? And the stimulus for antidiuretic hormone secretion will be a high serum osmolarity, which basically means your blood is more concentrated. Okay? Your blood is more concentrated. So if your blood is more concentrated, the idea here is to dilute it and conserve water. So that's what antidiuretic hormone would do. And of course, low blood volume would also be that, because we want to increase the volume by hanging on to the fluid, right? So it's a little body mechanism that we have, that antidiuretic hormone. Now, one of the other things that we will talk about a little bit in this lecture, even though it's kind of an anatomy and physiology type thing, is the hormones that come into play with the kidney. Remember, the kidney is all about cardiac output. I need a certain amount of blood flow to perfuse this organ to keep it running effectively. If that kidney loses its normal perfusion, what it normally wants to see, it's going to react by saying, I need that cardiac output. I need what I need to work properly and do the filtering job I have to do. So these body mechanisms go into effect, such as antidiuretic hormone, aldosterone. And that, again, influenced by circulating blood volume. What's aldosterone going to do? Hang on to sodium. What does sodium hang on to?
Water.
So that's, again, another way. So guys, if you can like just hang on to this concept that when the kidney's in trouble, if circulating blood volume drops for whatever reason, there are going to be mechanisms that the kidney's going to put into place to help increase the blood volume back to the kidney again. And hanging on, sodium will always hang on to water. That's why when your patients are on cardiac diets, or if they have heart failure, it's a low sodium diet, because you don't want them to be fluid overloaded. You don't want them having too much salt, because that salt's going to hang on to water and could volume overload them. So we're going to think about that with our patients who don't have good functioning kidneys. You don't necessarily want them overloaded with volume. All right, so, and then the distal convoluted distal tubule, again, is looking at acid-base regulation, which you're going to talk about in 2 weeks. I know you can't wait for that. And really what we're looking is to maintain a normal blood pH or homeostasis at 7.35 to 7.45. You kind of remember pH a little bit? That's why you took chemistry. But our blood has a pH. And our body loves to live at 7.35 to 7.45. It doesn't like to go below it or above it. If we go below it, we become acidotic. Our blood is too acid. If we go greater than 7.45, more alkalosis. And our kidneys are going to be a compensatory mechanisms that help bring blood pH back to its normal range. But that's another lecture. Okay, and you get Dean Martin to do that lecture for you, because she loves this topic. It's her favorite topic, so she loves to come. She likes to still get in here and do some teaching, and you're the class that she loves to teach, the beginning students with fluid and electrolytes. Okay, so 99% is reabsorbed in the plasma, 1% only excreted in urine. And what's a normal 24-hour urine output? Approximately. 12 to 1500. And that's going to be impacted by what? How much you drink. You drink, if you're somebody who's gulping down four or five, six of these a day, you're going to do what? Urinate more. Okay? All right, so, oh, there it is. Look at that. Somebody's reading their notes, right? Okay. What can you tell me about erythropoietin?
RBC
production, okay. Where is RBC, red blood cell?
Bone marrow.
But erythropoietin has something to do with that, right? It's what stimulates red blood cell production in the bone marrow. So why do I talk about it in the kidney lecture? What, Barry? It's where it's produced, okay? So erythropoietin is produced in our kidney. So our kidneys have something to do with our circulating red blood cell volume. Isn't that interesting? Now, what happens to individuals who have renal failure or kidneys that aren't functioning well? What happens? Okay, we're not going to produce as much erythropoietin. End result?
Anemia.
Anemia. This is why your chronic renal failure patients who over time have lost their kidney function, variety of reasons. We're going to talk in a few minutes why people would lose their kidney function. Okay, I'm going to give you that tonight. But one of the things you have to realize, all patients with chronic renal failure are anemic. You'll see that. You'll see hemoglobin's less than 10. Okay? The normal hemoglobin is around what? 12 to 16? All right? You're going to see hemoglobins of 8, 9, and they're not going to transfuse these patients. Sometimes you see transfusions, but they would have to be probably even lower. These people walk around every day with lower than normal circulating volume, circulating red blood cells, simply because they don't make erythropoietin. Now, is there a drug out there that can stimulate the red blood cells to make more, the bone marrow to make more red blood cells?
Yes.
Procrit, Epogen, might have heard that before. You see commercials once in a while for Procrit on TV. Procrit, P-R-O-C-R-I-T, and Epogen, E-P-O-G-E-N. These are two medications, they're called biological modifiers, that stimulate the bone marrow to make red blood cells. Isn't that a wonderful thing that we have that? Who else do you think would benefit from that?
Cancer patients.
Cancer patients getting chemotherapy, absolutely, very good. All right, renin. Who can tell me something about renin?
Oh, that's angiotensin.
Yep. Let me just catch up to myself here so I don't leave anything out. See, I'm getting too far ahead here. Where am I here? Okay. So, renin is another hormone that's produced by the kidney, and it's got a lot to do with blood flow regulation to the kidney. So basically, when the body does not, for whatever reason, produce enough cardiac output, we're going to stick with cardiac, you remember cardiac output, right? That's got to do with the amount of blood ejected by the left ventricle in 1 minute. So it's got to do with what kind of blood flow is getting to the major organs for perfusion. And perfusion is oxygenation, right? So let's say you were very dehydrated or involved in a major car accident and you hemorrhaged or something. And then the body has a lower circulating blood volume. The kidneys still say, what do the kidneys say? Where's my cardiac output? I need 25% of cardiac output or else I'm going to start shutting down. And do you want your kidneys to shut down? No. But your kidneys will shut down very quickly, even temporarily. If your blood pressure drops below a certain level, your kidneys aren't being adequately perfused, the kidneys will stop working. Your urine output will diminish. Okay? So, excuse me? Well, it can be. It depends. If it's an acute thing, a sudden drop in blood pressure, we want to try, we give volume, we give fluid, we give blood, we do everything we can to get blood pressure up. But sometimes if it's too long of a period of time, it can become irreversible, where we can't reverse the renal failure. So this renin basically is going to help with that conversion of angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. And we talked about angiotensin 1 and angiotensin 2. And what did we say angiotensin 2 is? What's it want to do to the vessels?
Vasoconstrict.
And when vasoconstriction occurs, what happens? It's a squeeze, right? And where are we squeezing from? We're squeezing from periphery to where? Major organs. The heart, the brain, the kidneys, the liver, the major organs. So anything that vasoconstricts is going to raise blood pressure. Anything that vasodilates is going to lower blood pressure. But if the kidneys are saying, I'm not feeling the love, I'm not getting this cardiac output that I need, they're going to say, get that renin going, get that angiotensin going, give me a good squeeze, and get that blood inward. Does that make sense? And that's how the kidney protects itself. It increases cardiac output to the kidney. I mean, it's not just the kidney, it's the other major organs too, but the kidney's also benefiting from that. So it kind of has these built-in defense mechanisms. Don't you love it?
So,
yes? Angiotensin 2 is what is the final product, and that's a potent vasoconstrictor. Well, no, kidneys just benefit from, it's a squeeze from the periphery, your arms and legs in. So it's all the organs are going to get it, but certainly the kidneys are going to benefit from it too. It's not like it's just going to the kidneys, okay? That would be nice, but going everywhere. All right, the kidneys also play a role in calcium and phosphate regulation too. So usually what you're going to see with our renal failure patients is they have low calcium from bone demineralization. Okay, they have low calcium but high phosphate. That's usually what you're going to see, a low calcium and a high phosphate in your renal failure patients. Okay, now this is just showing a little schematic for the erythropoietin and the bone marrow and the fact that it's, if there's reduced O2 levels in the blood, the kidney will release erythropoietin that stimulates the bone marrow to make more red blood cells. So it's just a defense mechanism there. And this is the angiotensin schematic. That you could blow this up and study it and feel real happy about it. Okay? Angiotensin and aldosterone. I put these things on here for you guys to look at them in your, you know, spare time. You know? Because you really learned about it already, right?
Right.
Okay, now the urethra. Now the reason why I put this on here is because I kind of got rid of all the other anatomy slides, but I did kind of want to tell you that the urethra kind of tries to protect the bladder from infection. So you have this bacteriostatic lining on the mucous membrane. Just go forward, you'll find it. It's there. And it forms what we call like a mucus plug at the very tip of the urethra before you're at the meatus, before the outside of the body. And that mucus plug will help, will keep bacteria from climbing up the urethra to get to your bladder, because your bladder is a sterile environment. It doesn't like bacteria. And because if you've got urine hanging out in your bladder, urine would be a fairly nice medium for bacteria to grow in. So that's why we got to keep it a sterile environment. So the urethra, you want to try to, you know, it wants to kind of seal off from outside bacteria. So how does that relate to education with your patients, even yourself?
Hygiene.
What about hygiene? Well, I mean, it's kind of not a clean area. Agreed?
Right.
So when you urinate or defecate, you should wipe yourself a certain way, correct?
Yes.
You don't want to go front to back. You want to go?
You want to go front
you
to back.
You want to go front to back. I was just going to say, you want to go right. That's what I just said, if you were paying attention. But the other thing, too, is keeping in mind females
shorter.
Have a shorter urethra than males. So do you think having a shorter urethra would make you more prone to urinary tract infections?
Yes.
Absolutely. And the shorter your urethra, who would have the shortest urethra? Baby girls. Little girls. So, I mean, you really need to do education. I mean, that they understand that they can get these little urinary tract infections that aren't necessarily a lot of fun. Right? And then the men have a longer urethra. Okay? And we can see 20 centimeters in length. Okay, so we have a Clifford question to start off with here. Okay? Right off the bat. Okay, so a patient with long-standing history of diabetes is voicing concerns about kidney disease. The client asks the nurse where urine is formed in the kidney. The nurse's response is where it's formed in the kidney. Okay, we ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's see what everybody's got here. I mean, this is kind of a close one, right? Ah, so we split between the glomerulus and the nephron. So what's the difference there? The nephron consists of the glomerulus, but what's the functional unit? What's actually doing the work?
Glomerulus. The glomerulus, right.
Okay, the glomerulus. That's where you get the glomerular filtration rate, remember? Glomerular filtration rate. So I would go with A on that one, okay? Even though it's an anatomy question. But, I mean, it's your patient might ask you, but oh, I don't want to put the flipper. What am I doing? Okay. The act of urination, again, it's under control of the brain. And you do need to have coordination of the higher brain centers to do this. You can suppress the contraction, the urge to void, for a certain amount of time. And this is going to be under sphincter control, too. Now, your bladder can normally hold up to 600 mLs of urine, but a normal voiding is usually around 300. But you can, that's when you really, really need to go, right? When you really feel that urge to go. But you can feel the urge sometimes, smaller amounts. But you can, even though you sense it, you can pretty much sometimes keep going. So as the bladder volume increases, the walls will stretch, sending an impulse to the micturition center, which is in your spine, and then up to your brain, and that'll open up the sphincter. Okay?
Everybody's going to run for the
bathroom. I know, everybody's going to run for the bathroom now. It's giving you the urge to voice. Okay, so.
Look.
Aren't these little pictures cute? All right, so factors that influence urination. That's what we're going to talk about now. So disease certainly can do it. We're going to talk about three different instances where disease can do it. Growth and development, sociocultural, and I've got a slide for all of these. So we'll talk about each one individually. So disease. So there's three different situations here. Three different situations. So prerenal. Basically, this is a disease condition outside of the kidney. Okay, something that's going on outside of the kidney is going to impact the kidney's ability. So what do you think, outside the kidney can influence cardiac, anything affecting cardiac output, right? Anything, an MI where a patient goes into cardiac failure, pump failure, anything that drops the blood pressure, anything like that, anything that's going to have to do with decreasing that circulating blood volume. So anything that's going to decrease the blood flow to the kidney with a resultant decrease in perfusion to the renal tissue. Okay, so any cardiac type of condition will do that. And how you'll see that happen is a decrease in urinary output. You'll see that decrease. And we'll talk about what we're going to consider a low urinary output in a little bit. So the alteration is outside the system. And you're going to have that decrease in perfusion results in what we call oliguria. Circle that. Oliguria. Oliguria means a diminished urinary output. And do we want to give that a more definitive definition of what we want to say oliguria is? Less than 30 mLs per hour. Okay, and you're going to say now, how the heck do I know if I'm urinating 30 mLs an hour? I don't urinate every hour. But this kind of patient would have a catheter in. And we would be able to monitor how much urinary output they put out over certain periods of time. Now, how often do we empty catheter bags?
Every
shift, which we're going to say is 8 hours, even though you see most nurses working 12 hours. We calculate the intake and output, and this is part of output. We calculate that every 8 hours. So based on the fact that we want to see at least 30 mLs per hour put out by our patient to say they have normal kidney function, at least, how many mLs should be in that bag at the end of 8 hours?
240.
At least 240. So if you're dumping catheter bags with less than 240, you got a concern here. Okay, you got a concern. And there's going to be different instances. Any of these things that we're talking about can impact that. But certainly cardiac output can do it. That's it on that one? Okay. So prerenal conditions. These are the kinds of things that can lead to you having a prerenal alteration in urinary function. Okay, that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Decreased volume. Because decreased volume is going to give you what? Decreased cardiac output and decreased perfusion. Dehydration decreased volume, right? And I can truly tell you, has anyone felt they were dehydrated?
Yes.
Oh, let me tell you. Last week when I had to go to Johns Hopkins with my brother, I got that. Has anyone had that intestinal bug that's going around? Oh, let me tell you, I got it Saturday night. It lasted till Thursday. And I'm telling you, I was so dehydrated by Tuesday that I was like drinking these bottles of water every hour and I still felt lousy. When you're dehydrated, you just feel lousy and you do get a headache, right? So, I mean, you really feel it when you're dehydrated. So you just absolutely feel lousy. So dehydration, now we can take care of our dehydration, right? If I feel I'm dehydrated, I just drink more. But think about some of the folks in the nursing home or in the hospital. Are they drinking it all for you guys? Some of these people aren't even taking a sip. And if that goes day after day after day after day, and it's not being replenished, and they're not saying anything because they necessarily can't, they're becoming more and more dehydrated. So this is definitely going to take a toll here. Hemorrhage makes sense, right? All these kind of make sense. Shock. And shock would be decreased volume, decreased pump failure. You learn about shock in nursing 230. You'll learn about shock. Sepsis, okay, which is a major blood infection, which basically leads to decreased circulating volume. Anaphylactic reactions can do this, because aren't they all outside of the kidney? All these things are happening outside of the kidney. And then cardiac pump failure. Now, what could lead to cardiac pump failure?
Myocardial.
Okay, a heart attack. What else? Cardiomyopathy. Anything that decreases this congestive heart failure, atrial fibrillation. Sometimes anything that can decrease the pumping action of the heart. Okay, can lead to decreased cardiac output and decreased circulating volume. Understand the concept, guys, and you'll have no trouble with this all the way through. Go ahead. It can lead to decrease in blood pressure and then a decrease in circulating blood volume. Okay? It's just the body goes into a collapse and everything vasodilates. And when things vasodilate, what happens? Blood pressure drops. But if you have a massive vasodilatation happening in your body, which happens in anaphylactic reactions, your blood pressure plummets. A plummet in blood pressure will lead to a decrease in perfusion to the kidney, and then you'll see these, oliguric type events happening. Okay, now renal disease. This will be things happening, where do you think? Inside the kidney. So anything that happens, anything inside the kidney. So, nephrotoxic agents. Now, this is going back to pharmacology, but remember we said there could be some drugs that just by their composition can be toxic to the kidney. And sometimes we have to give them, especially antibiotics, because they're the only drug that'll work for that particular condition that we're trying to treat. So we give them the nephrotoxic agent, but we monitor kidney function while we're giving it. And we monitor their BUN and creatinine levels, the blood studies that give us an indication of whether or not the body is getting rid of waste products. Okay, that's the BUN, blood urea nitrogen, and creatinine. Remember those? Mm-hmm. We did talk about them. So nephrotoxic agents. These are chemicals or drugs that can, just by their makeup, cause kidney damage. But we have to give them, so we just monitor kidney function while we give them. And contrast medium from CAT scans can do that too. Blood transfusion reaction can do it. It causes microclotting inside the kidney. Okay, a hemolytic reaction. Disease of the glomeruli, like glomerular nephritis, an inflammation of the glomeruli. Tumors, makes sense, right? Diabetes, okay. How does diabetes do it? What do you think diabetes does?
Circulation.
Well, again, it's going to impact the circulation inside the kidney.
Perfusion.
And, you know, the diabetes is a disease that can affect all kinds of tissues in the body, the eyes, you know, the heart, everything. So the thing is with diabetes, if you keep the disease in check, now what do I mean keep the disease in check? Keep your blood pressures monitored and at a consistently normal as you can do it. Because you got to remember, the people with diabetes, they have a problem with insulin production or insulin management. So when we eat things, our blood sugar rises. If our blood sugar stays high, over time, it will affect all the cells in our body and can make them less effective, and that's what's going to happen in the kidney. It makes the kidney not work as well anymore. It changes the cell, you know, how well the cells in the kidney will work. So over time, diabetes that's left uncontrolled or not kept well in line can lead to renal failure. That's one of the main reasons, that and hypertension. And hypertension would probably, you know, that hypertension is another reason why people go into renal failure, because it over time will change the cellular structure of the organ. So systemic diseases like diabetes and hypertension, infection, and hereditary diseases like polycystic kidney disease. Now post-renal, what's that gonna be? After the kidney. Okay, so this is usually an obstruction after the kidney. So what does that mean? The kidney can make the urine, but what can it do? Get rid of it. So if I can't get rid of it, what's gonna happen? It's gonna back up and back up, like the kidney's almost gonna like burst, right? It becomes a major issue. The kidneys kind of swell all up. They make the urine, but the body can't get rid of it. Okay? So basically what you're gonna see with this is obstruction due to kidney stones. So we gotta get rid of those kidney stones. And look at where kidney stones can be. Right in the renal pelvis. They can be all over. Anyone ever had a kidney stone? Terrible pain. Very painful. So what do you think this thing is here? This is a male. It's prostate gland. This is called benign prostatic hypertrophy, BPH. It's an enlarged prostate. Now, women can't get this, right? Mm-hmm. But men sure can. As men age, their prostates can enlarge. And it can enlarge so much that, see how, is there much room for urine to get through there? So that's why a lot of men have problems with urination. They dribble, they have like a few little drops come out and that's it. But they have the urine in their bladder, but they just can't go. So what do you think they're gonna need over time? They're gonna have surgery to help open this up. They have prostate surgery. They kind of what we call like a roto-rooter. They go in there and scrape away some of that enlarged prostate. It's called the transurethral resection of the prostate, or a TURP, TURP. Transurethral resection of the prostate to open up this passageway again. Okay? Do you think it'd be hard to get a catheter up through there?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, real hard. Sometimes we have to have the urologist come in with men with enlarged prostates to get the, because we have to figure out a way to get the urine out.
I would think painful too.
Oh yeah, yeah. We gotta figure out a very painful. We gotta figure out a way to get that urine out of there. So we do have some options though. Okay? That's prostatic hypertrophy. And neurogenic bladder basically is a neurological condition where the body can make the urine, but remember I said you had to have good coordination with the upper brain centers in order for micturition to happen. If there's an interruption, if some kind of spinal cord injury or something like that, sometimes you can get what we call a neurogenic bladder, and we make the urine, it gets into the bladder, but we can't empty it out correctly. And tumors. Okay, so this just gives you a little bit of information on kidney stone. So, you know, just so you know, nausea and vomiting, a lot of pain, flank pain back here. This is the flank. A lot of flank pain. Okay? All right, so renal diseases. Now, usually this is long standing enough that it's causing irreversible damage. Now, if you have a temporary drop in blood pressure, cardiac output to the kidneys drop. You might have a decrease in urine output for a short time. Very cute little snake. Bless you. Very cute. But not my, I'm sorry. It was just the cutest little sneeze. But you have a temporary drop of urinary output, but then the kidneys, you get the blood pressure back up and the kidneys recover. But if it's long-standing, like from diabetes, or a long-standing drop in blood pressure, sometimes you get irreversible damage. Chronic renal disease, and then it can drop to end-stage renal disease. Chronic renal disease, something else that you might see it referred to as renal insufficiency. Have you seen that maybe on some of your charts, renal insufficiency? Just means those kidneys aren't working the way they used to. But unfortunately, we need them to work good, okay? We need them to filter out the waste products, so we do need to have that happen. End-stage renal disease means that the kidneys are no longer filtering at a rate that will keep the body alive on their own. So we need to add in some kind of medical therapy, such as hemodialysis, peritoneal dialysis, or a kidney transplant for survival. Okay? That's when you get to end stage. Anything end stage means you need a lot of help in order to keep it working. Okay? So you need treatment for survival here. So chronic renal failure, usually, I mean, they have a glomerular filtration rate 90. It's 60, guys, less than 60. I don't know why this slide says 90. It's 60. Okay? And the comorbidities. Comorbidity means that the chronic diseases that usually go hand in hand with renal failure are going to be diabetes, hypertension, and renal artery stenosis. Because renal artery stenosis would be a narrowing of that renal artery, which would lead to what? Diminished blood perfusion. Everything goes back to perfusion, guys, right? When you don't get oxygen, everything goes back to oxygen, doesn't it? And then chronic renal failure. You get headaches, inability to decrease ability to concentrate urine. Polyuria, you might see a lot of urine being made at first, and then it goes to the oliguria, the low urine output. Okay, there's a diuretic phase sometimes to renal failure. Now, we're not studying necessary renal failure today. I'm just giving you some overview of that. The other time you see polyuria is, polyuria means you put out lots and lots and lots and lots of urine. Almost looks like water, it's clear. It's a sign of diabetes, okay, of insulin, type 1 diabetes. Someone who's urinating all the time, you might want to consider that they're new diabetic. That's one of the signs. Polyuria, polydipsia, and hunger, and rapid weight loss. Polyuria is a very high urinary output. Polydipsia, these people are thirsty all the time. Unquenchable thirst. But then they're urinating all the time, too. Okay, increased BUN and creatinine, weakness, fatigue, increased blood pressure. See, the anemia is coming in now, starting to get the anemia, okay? And then the glomerular filtration rate will decrease. Then chronic end stage, this is where you need dialysis now. Your glomerular filtration rate is less than 15 milliliters a minute. You need dialysis or a kidney transplant at this point, and you can see, don't you love these little things? They're nice little things to study from. Okay? Okay, so uremic syndrome. This is what you're going to see in that renal failure situation. Somebody whose kidneys aren't working properly. So decreased urine output, less than 30 milliliters an hour. Protein. You'll see if you were to do a microscopic examination of the urine, you'd see protein in the urine. Normally, protein would not be in your urine, okay? Volume overload, because your kidneys, you're not urinating, you're hanging on to all this volume, right? Because normally when you drink, what do? You urinate. But if your kidneys aren't working, you're not urinating, you keep drinking, where's that all that volume going? It's staying inside you. What's going to happen? Blood pressure's going to go up? Heart's not going to be able necessarily to take on that extra volume, and you can go into heart failure, okay? So you'll see a lot of times these new dialysis patients going into heart failure, which is what I'm saying there, congestive heart failure. You can see cardiac dysrhythmias. Why do you think cardiac dysrhythmias? Why do you think? Somebody give me an educated guess. What else does the kidney get rid of, Dave?
I was going to say you're going to dilute your all of your electrolytes.
Mm-hmm. Normally your kidney is doing what? Getting rid of the excess sodium, excess potassium. So if the kidneys aren't working, what's climbing? Your electrolytes, your sodium and your potassium. Potassium is one of those electrolytes which you'll find out in 2 weeks. The body likes a certain window of value, you know, 3.5 to 5. You know, the heart doesn't tolerate a very low or a very high potassium level. You'll see cardiac arrhythmias. And remember, we talked about cardiac arrhythmias with our oxygenation level. Which were the bad ones? The ones that you really wouldn't want to have. What were they called? Ventricular tachycardia, and then the most lethal of all, ventricular fibrillation. But high potassium levels can cause ventricular tachycardia, which can lead to ventricular fibrillation. So can very low potassium levels. But in this case, with our renal failure patients, we're looking at high levels. So, how will our renal failure patient present to you lab-wise? Elevated BUN, elevated creatinine, elevated potassium, elevated phosphate, decreased calcium. That's what they look like on the labs. Okay? That's how the lab studies will look like. Nausea and vomiting, because all these poisons are circulating in the body, right? You don't feel so good. You get a uremic frost. It almost looks like a white flakiness to the skin. You might just think it's very, very dry skin, but it almost looks like a white powder on the skin. And I saw a patient not too long ago over at Hamilton that had the uremic frost, and I hadn't really seen it in a long time. But you actually almost look like you want to dust it off of them. Okay? It's like a and it's basically the toxins coming out through the skin.
Uric acid?
Yeah. It's almost like it's just like a very fine flakiness almost.
Do they have higher instances of gout?
They can. But yeah, I mean, you don't really see gout so much with renal failure.
And why is the calcium low?
Because of bone demineralization occurs during renal failure. You get because of the kidney not functioning properly, you get bone demineralization. So that's why the calcium is released into the bloodstream.
Why is it low? Oh, it's low, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the calcium is low. The calcium does. I think what happens is also phosphate levels go high, and when phosphate goes high, calcium proportionately goes low. So calcium does drop. That's a good point, though. The bone demineralization releases it into the serum, though. You're right. I will check that out a little further. Anemia, we know why, right? Because of the erythropoietin not being produced by the kidney. All right, now these are the labs that I just told you about. It is a decreased calcium. But I also gave you some numbers, even though I gave you 90 again. It's really more like 60. Again, these labs will change slightly based on the hospital that runs the lab. Okay, you might see the numbers change slightly. Like instead of 8.6, it might be 8.5. Okay, but just keep in mind what's elevated and what's decreased. Okay.
My patient, she's in intensive
medical. Yeah.
And she doesn't urinate at all.
Okay.
She
yep. That's anuric. Anuric, A-N-U-R-I-C. Anuric means no urine output. And some renal failure patients have no urinary output at all. But what I'm sure she's on dialysis.
Like 4 or 5 times.
Yeah, after not a day, a week.
But now, after this, if this isn't working, would they go for like a kidney transplant?
What do you think?
Yes.
Well, what do you think's going to... kidney transplants don't come up in a couple seconds. We're going to get there. But we'll talk about who gets a kidney transplant and who doesn't. We'll talk about that in a second. But these are just so you have an idea of what you're going to see in renal labs. So start looking at your renal studies on your patients when you can.